Good afternoon, and welcome to the December meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum. Since 1985, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States today and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own rights. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, and as well as instructions on how to join at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is lucky today to have one of Maine's own, Tom DeMarco, a principal of the Atlantic Systems Guild, a systems think tank with offices in the United States, Germany, and Great Britain. Tom's a past winner of the Jean-Dominique Warnier Prize for lifetime contribution to the information sciences. He's one of the founders and a past president of PopTech and a fellow of the Qatar Consortium. He's the author of 8 books on computer systems development, management, and organizational design, plus 3 works of fiction. His best-known work is Slack, Getting Past Burnout, Busy Work, and the Myth of Total Efficiency, published by Random House. It addresses the question, why are we all so damned busy, and offers some unsettling answers. His first work of mainstream fiction, a comic novel called Dark Harbor House, was published 10 years ago, 2001, in a short story collection, Lieutenant America and Miss Apple Pie, was published in 2003. His talk today is a particular timely one. Cyber war, science or science fiction? Tom.
Thank you, Mac. Thank you. Back in the years where we're suddenly coming to grips with what this thing called the internet was, say the mid-1990s, it was very fashionable to say in ponderous tones that the internet changes everything. And so the question was whether it changes the way we conduct wars, the way we conduct foreign policy. That's a slam dunk. Of course it changes that. My own work with the Defense Procurement Agency and the Early Council tells me, without giving away anything the least bit classified, that the way we conduct the military today and the way it would conduct any kind of warfare is changed drastically by not the internet, but by the parallel internets that are used in the military, and by the basic thing, the digital interconnection that we're all so aware of. The term cyberware, however, cyber war, has a slightly different connotation, more defensive than offensive. Everybody would understand that the conduct of offensive war is very digital today. But cyber war really relates to whether our cyber infrastructure might be a target for somebody else's attack, just as the North-South railways in Germany were targets for precision bombing during the Second World War. How about our internet backbone? We depend on it today as much as the Germans depended on their railway system. Might it be a target for attack by some other nation? And that is a complicated question to ask because at once the internet, the backbone, is so robust and so resilient that it would be hard to knock it down. If you send me a message from your computer to mine, say you send a file, a picture of some of your dog or whatever, and it comes to me not as a single transmission but as a bunch of packets. It's broken up, let's say, into 25 packets, and they come, each one finding his way over the internet, over the backbone, and coming to my computer. And the presumption of the architects of the internet was that any one of those nodes or conduits might be down at any given time, and therefore that packet might have to find its way a different way to get to my computer. Well, it might even happen that the first half dozen of those packets find their way along one path, and then when the next one comes along trying to get to me, It encounters a disruption of some sort. That, for instance, the node has been blown up by a terrorist, or has gone down, or is just consumed in traffic. And when that happens, that packet and the ones behind it, presumably, would find their way to me via a different path, and they'd all get assembled at the end, and I'd see a picture of your dog, and neither you nor the sender nor I, the receiver, would know that some of those packets were detoured along the way between you and me. It's a very robust system that expects to be down all the time, expects parts of it to be down, jammed, bottlenecked, destroyed, and the various packets have to find their way via different paths in order to get where they're going without disruption to anyone on either end of the transmission. So it's a very robust network. It's hard to knock it down. If you were to plant a bomb in one place, there's no one place you could plant it that would do detectable damage to the rest of us users of the system. But at the same time, it's the most exposed national resource you've ever seen. A couple of 20-something unemployed jihadists in a cyber cafe in Lahore can plant a data packet on virtually any piece of the internet that they want to get it to. And of course, if they could get that data packet to do some damage, then that would be cyber war. Cyber war could happen via a mechanism something like that. The term is necessarily speculative. There's never been a cyber war. So I'm going to be speculating a little bit as I go through this. I'm going to tell you about some cyber skirmishes. There have been 16 of them generally understood to be something of the nature of what cyber war would be, an attack by one nation on another or by a terrorist group on a nation, something like that, via the information infrastructure. 16 of those, I'm going to tell you about two of them in some detail, and you can see the pattern, I think, from that. The first one, I also want to talk about cybercrime. The methods of crime and the methods of warfare in general are quite different. Criminals use switchblades and crowbars and revolvers, and warriors use guns and planes and bombs and aircraft carriers. So in general, there isn't a lot of similarity between the way crime is conducted and the way warfare is conducted. But in the cyber world, that's not so. The methods of cyber crime give a clear indicator of what methods would be used in anything that would qualify as a cyber war. The first of the two incidents I want to talk to you about is the Estonian incursion of April 2007. Estonia is a little country on the Baltic that has a very complicated history of being rolled over and captured and dismembered and annexed and destroyed and absorbed more times than it can count by such nations as Russia, Prussia, Austria, Germany, Poland. Livonia was one of the conquerors of Estonia at one time. And more recently, it was annexed by the Soviet Union in the end of 1939 and made into an Estonian-Soviet republic. You can see why they would want Estonia as part of their domain, because it's a wonderful access to the Baltic Sea. The Soviet Union being largely landlocked, all of its accesses are very important. So this quadrupled, the acquisition of Estonia quadrupled its access to the outside, to the oceans. It was absorbed by the Soviet Union in 1939, captured by the Germans in 1941, liberated by the Soviet Union again in 1944. And when they moved in the second time into what is they still thought of as the Estonian Soviet Republic, they were very serious about making it virtually part of Russia, part of the integral part of the Soviet Union, in particular where their nuclear submarine bases were stationed, where many of the ports, the islands, were hugely fortified. What they did at that time was they made it impossible for native Estonians to occupy the coast at all, and certain of the cities were off limits to native Estonians. The native Estonians were considered troublemakers by the Russians, and they deported 275,000 of them to the Gulag in various places, mostly to Siberia, and most of them were never seen again. At the same time, they brought in 500,000 Russians to occupy the space left by the native Estonians. So today, there are still something like 500,000 ethnic Russians out of a population of 1.3 million people. So you can see this is a kind of a powder keg. It has been through this entire period with these two intensely different populations with very different ideas about who Estonia, to whom Estonia belongs. By about 1991, the Soviet Union was coming unglued, and Estonia, at least two-thirds of the Estonians, declared their independence, and that was 1991. It was acknowledged toward the end of 1991 by the Russians, but it was 1994 before they actually withdrew their armed forces. So it was an occupied nation until 1994. And today it is still a powder keg with these two very different populations, this powerful Russian population representing about a third of the total, with a very different perspective on the way things ought to be done than the native Estonians. It has become the most successful in terms, purely economic terms, of the ex-Soviet republics in terms of GDP per capita today. When they left, or when they arrived in the late 40s, the Russians built themselves a memorial, and it's called the Bronze Soldier of Tallinn, and it represents to the Russians the heroic effort of the Russians to liberate Tallinn in particular. Now, in point of fact, Tallinn was not exactly liberated. The Germans had walked out before the Russians walked in. But still, here we see the Bronze Soldier of Tallinn looking very forlorn. That's because of the great sacrifices of his fellow Soviets to free the people, the not very appreciative people of Estonia, from in part of what the Russians still today call the Great Patriotic War. And this soldier has been, which is chock full, exactly in the middle of Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, in a park on the highlands, in the most obvious place that you would put such a memorial. They also buried there 10 or 15 Russian soldiers who died during the early occupation. And all of this was a memorial to themselves, actually. It was viewed by the native Russians as a symbol of their claim on Estonia, viewed by the Estonians as a symbol of Soviet occupation. So you can see there's a bone of contention here, a vein of contention. And in early 2007, the Pro-Patria Party put forth a motion, which was bound to pass in the Tallinn City Council, to have the Bronze Soldier of Tallinn destroyed. That was the motion. Not to have it moved, not to have it sent back to Russia, but to have it broken up into its constituent pieces and thrown away. That was going to pass, and the Estonian government, the federal government, panicked and moved the soldier to a military, and all the graves, by the way, to a military cemetery off in the boondocks someplace so that nobody could get to it. This was clearly an incident to inflame the passions of all the different people, and there were riots in Tallinn for two nights. And at the end of the riot period, all of a sudden, the Estonian infrastructure, the information infrastructure, went fairly much missing. It was brought to its knees by a cyber attack, which virtually everyone believes came from Russia. In fact, you can trace a lot of it as coming directly from Russian government servers, but some of it came from elsewhere. I'll explain that in a moment. The cyber attack would not have been noticed by most of the rest of the world except for one thing, a product built by the Estonians, who are very sharp, very well educated, and very aware of information technology. One of the things that they built that they gave to the world is something called Skype. Many of you use Skype all the time. It's a free telephone and video phone service. And at the time of the cyber attack, there were 195 million users of Skype worldwide. So they were somewhat inconvenienced by the attack. Most of them weren't, because Skype is a very distributed system, but some were, and all the talk over Skype in those days was, oh my God, they could bring us all to the, bring Skype to its knees, and that would be kind of frightening. Now, the way this worked, the way the ministries, the federal government, the servers of the ministries, the federal government, the banks, and Skype were brought down was something called a distributed denial of service attack. And I want to tell you about that, because it's a technique of both cybercrime and cyber warfare. And the right way to think about it, an easy way to think about it, is imagine that you and 999 of your friends are deeply annoyed at eBay, for example, and you would like, eBay has raised its rates or refuses to carry, you know, a certain class of things that you like to sell, and porn, for instance, that they're no longer allowing you to sell porn. And so you and 999 of your colleagues get on your computers, and you just sit there and attempt to log in, false logins to eBay as fast as you can. Now, how fast could you do a false, you know, make up an imaginary ID and an imaginary password and hit return and then just do it again and again and again and again and again? How fast could you do that? Well, maybe 10 seconds. You could do maybe six of those a minute, and that means that all of you together are generating 6,000 a minute, which is a large number compared to the number of legitimate logins that eBay has experienced in any given moment, and therefore it can't service its client base. It can't take the legitimate person who wants to buy or sell something in and let them log in, because all of you are stifling it. Now, that's the way it could work. That's not the way it works. The way it works is all of these 1,000 computers, or tens of thousands of computers, in particular in the Tallinn attacks, all of these computers that were part of it were not individuals at their home PCs entering false logins. What they were was what I'm going to call zombie computers. That a zombie computer is a computer whose owner didn't do all those things that you're supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to keep the security up to date. You're not supposed to run foreign free software that comes to you from a friend, and you're not supposed to download, you know, videos from the porn sites and so forth. You're not supposed, but these people did do those things, and by hook or by crook, their computers got corrupted, and they got taken over using a very clever exploit developed by bored teenagers, a very clever exploit that allows those computers to seem to be perfectly normal, doing all the things you like to do during the day, but at night while you're asleep, if it's on 24/7, and if you haven't done something to reclaim control over this, it's listening to a channel called the IRC chat channel, listening to a channel for a particular signal, and when that signal comes along, it downloads software, and that software takes over the computer, and it does whatever that software tells it to do. Where did these zombies come from? Where did the ones that were used by Russians come from to do this distributed denial of service? They rented them. They rented them from teenagers who are in the business of zombie farming. They are looking for computers, looking around the net, trolling the net, looking for a computer which has been left with open vulnerabilities, using an exploit to seize that computer and then covering up their tracks to be able to use it later. And you can rent these. They're expensive, but you can rent these to send spam, for instance. So the typical spam that comes to you, that's annoying as hell because it came in, filled up your mailbox with all this ridiculous stuff that you don't want to look at, might well have come through your computer. It might have been a message sent to you from your own computer because your computer has been zombieized. And while you can use it during the day, at night it's busy doing whatever the bad guys want it to do. So your computer has been zombieized. And these zombie networks are called botnets, and they are for rent by the people who own them. They're for rent for anything you want to do with them. You can use them to send porn. You can use them to conduct a distributed denial of service attack on some company that has annoyed you. You can rent these through the internet. Now, it's not, I've never been able to find out how to get to them, but the people that need to seem to be able to. So let me give you a couple of definitions here. A distributed denial of service attack is an attack on a website or server, making it impossible for it to serve its legitimate clients. A zombie is a compromised computer, maybe yours, which has been enlisted into a network to do, on a for-hire basis, spam distribution and distributed denial of service attacks, or other things. A botnet is an assembly of these zombies available to be rented for whatever purpose. An exploit is a trick that these teenagers have used in order to compromise possibly your computer. Another term I'd like to introduce is a vulnerability. That's something about your system that makes it vulnerable to the kind of an attack that would be that might make it a zombie. I want to tell you about one of those exploits, one of the tricks. Just so you, I'm going to tell you in more detail than you want to know, but in order to give you some sense of how these things work and the minds of the people that that do this sort of thing, that compromise other people's computers. So in order to do that, I want you to imagine the memory of your computer as a space where every dot, let's say it's a big rectangle, and every dot inside this rectangle is a byte, that is the component, the lowest level component of memory. It's a byte, and you've got, depending on how modern your computer is, you've got 2 billion of these bytes of data. Or if it's an older computer, the kind that are typically targets for zombification, then it probably has got a few hundred million bytes of memory. And let's look inside one of those bytes of memory. Computer memories are all made up of zeros and ones. So this particular byte that I look at in detail has the contents 10010111. Now, what does that mean? What can we tell from looking at that one byte? Well, if it's a number that somebody stored in there, the number is 151, if it's a number. So there may be a count of something which has now been counted up to the number 151. You could do that if you remember how to do your digital arithmetic, 151. But if it's a letter, it's a lowercase p. That particular pattern is a lowercase p. And if it's a piece of an image, if it's a picture of flowers or something like that, that particular number might represent a light lavender pixel. And if it's an instruction, if what we're looking at is something in the middle of lines of code, that particular sequence is what's called a no-op. It's an instruction. I was certainly surprised to find this when I was studying digital circuits, but all computers have an instruction called a no-op, which doesn't do anything. And it's not obvious why it has that, but it has to do with low-level counting, of counting very short intervals by just going through a number of nanoseconds of code. So that's a no-op instruction. So depending on what it is, depending on who it is that's put it there and what they think of it as, it might be a number, it might be a text, for instance, a lowercase p, it might be a lavender pixel, or it might be a no-op instruction, or maybe many other things. But I want to distinguish now between the ones that are part of program, like in this particular case, the no-op instruction, and those that are part of data. All the others are data. Now, I want you to think of the inside of your computer as though it were made up of regions of three colors. Regions of green, that would be executable programs. Regions of blue, that's the data space that the programs are executed upon. And regions of white, which are areas of memory that are currently unused. So very early computers filled up their program space from the top of the computer, their data space from the bottom of the computer, and the space in the middle was empty. So you would have a big green rectangle on the top, a white rectangle in the middle, and a blue rectangle on the bottom, which turns out to be the flag of Uzbekistan upside down, as it turns out. Not particularly important here, but that's the way ancient computers were organized for no particular reason. It just happened that was the convention. But today, that's not true. Today, computers have their memories allocated very dynamically. So the inside of your computer, if you looked at it using the scheme of green, blue, and white, would have all kinds of ribbons, some of them instructions of code, some of them data areas being acted upon by those instructions of code, and some of them white, meaning they haven't currently been used. And the particular thing I want to talk to you about is something called a buffer exploit. And the buffer exploit presumes that one particular program and its associated data, so a green stripe and the associated blue stripe, are in the process at some point of issuing a read instruction soliciting input from the outside world. So deep inside this green area, there's an instruction that says, go to one of the ports and look for incoming data. Now, the programmer who writes this is accomplishing something. Maybe he's doing peer-to-peer file sharing or something like that. And the first thing he expects from some as yet unidentified person who's answering this read, who's putting data into the computer or offering data to fill this read, the thing he's expecting is an email address identifying the sender. An email address, you know what it is, it's letters@letters.com or .net or .us or whatever. An email address is maybe 30 or 40 characters. The programmer allocates 50. The largest email he can think of is 50 characters. So he allocates a little buffer of 50 characters to receive the results of that read-in. But to his surprise, to everyone's surprise, what he's dealing with is not really the peer-to-peer file-sharing program he thinks it is. It's a teenager emulating that, sitting on the outside, keying in characters, and he doesn't limit himself to 50 characters. What he types, and he's got plenty of time, 50,000 characters. Now, what character is he typing in? It's a lowercase p. Why is that? Because the lowercase p is an instruction that just passes control to the next instruction, and the next instruction, and the next instruction. And so his idea, his nefarious plot, is that this buffer overflow will go beyond the allocated area for it and begin to intrude in other people's allocated areas, and maybe, if he's lucky, will intersect a piece of program. And if it does, and that program is executed, all this depends on luck, that program is executed, the exploit that he has placed at the bottom of this well of no-ops, the exploit at the bottom will gain control because the program that thought it was doing some other totally different thing bumps into the well of no-ops, drops down through the well of no-ops, and lands on the payload. That is a piece of code which now gains control of your computer. Now, that piece of code is so difficult to write. I mean, you can't imagine how hard that is. You have to understand the operating system, the programming language, the data space. You have to have a deep, intimate understanding of the nature of your target machine in order to write the payload code. And it's not enough to write it. You then have to understand what machine language code, lowest level machine language code, would be the equivalent of this program that you've written for yourself in C or C++ or one of the modern languages. And not only that, you have to figure out what the alphabetic character equivalents are of those codes. Because at the end of your long string of lowercase p's, you begin to type other things, characters, B's and semicolons and R's and 1's and so forth, that constitute the alphabetic equivalent of a program that will do this nefarious thing that you have in mind. And who is doing all of this? And doing it again and again and again, because the first time you do it, it doesn't work, and the second time it doesn't work, and the 10th time it doesn't work, but the 11th time it does work, and you've only got, 25 hours and 150 hours to figure out how to write the exploit, and every single thing has to be keyed in. Who's doing this? A teenager whose parents think he has ADD. So this is a buffer exploit, and it accomplishes what I'm calling zomblification. It's one of the ways. It's not the only way. No, it's not even the most common way. The most common way is that you've received an email virus, or you've taken software from somebody else, or you've downloaded from a website, or you've executed a program. You know you shouldn't do that, but it just was too... it was too enticing, so you executed a program that came to you from an unknown sender, and that's one of the, those are the ways, the typical ways that zombification happens of your computer. But zombification, co-opting of servers, very often happens using things like the buffer overflow exploit. Every time a computer is compromised that way, it's because a programmer was sloppy. And that programmer who wrote that piece of code I was talking about never should have written it with a fixed buffer of only 50 characters. He should have said, I'm allocating 50 characters, but I want the read to interrupt if the 51st character is done. And most people, most programmers today would do that, but there are still tens of thousands of reads that have not been fixed inside an operating system like Windows, for instance. And these are vulnerabilities, and these are the reasons that you're continually getting advisories to update the security of your program. Zombification involves an exploit used to plant a payload in your computer or in your server, a payload which inserts a backdoor. I'm defining terms here. A backdoor is a piece of program that activates itself every now and then and can be used to seize your computer for the moment to do some terrible thing because that's what the client has asked to have done, and then gives the control back. A backdoor wakes up when at odd hours and issues a read on one of the computer's ports to see if anybody's rented it, and if so, if it sees a prearranged signal, it downloads a much more elaborate payload, that is the payload of the client, and uses that to distribute spam or to do a distributed denial of service attack, or to compromise the computer further by looking through its keychains to see if it can discover what your passwords are, who your correspondents are, how to approach your bank and transfer money out of your account. Now, I'm talking about this. This is cybercrime, by the way. This is a cybercrime technique, but it was used in the cyber attack by Russia on Estonia, and is used on many of the other cyber attacks that have been recorded, and that's why I'm talking about it here. But before going on and getting back to the subject of cyber war, let me answer the question that's on many of your minds. I can tell by the color of your face. Is my computer zombified? And the short answer to that is, if it's on 24/7 and if it's old, in other words, if it's too old to be able to run the latest version of whatever its operating system is, and you haven't been installing all of the security upgrades, it probably has been zombified. It probably has been. And if it has, most of the uses of it will be something that you're sharing it with the teenagers. They use it at night, you use it in the daytime, and that's fine. But it might also be exploited further by those very same teenagers who will be pouring anything you can do on your computer, they can do on your computer as well. In other words, they can make it do whatever they want to do, and they can search through it, and they can gain access to, for instance, a low-level password that you've used to sign on to a chat group. That happens to be the same password you use to sign on to your bank account, and they just take a chance on that. And maybe if your TurboTax file is on there, they can get your Social Security number, and maybe your brokerage account allows a Social Security number as a user ID. You know, this is bad stuff. And if you want to do something about this, I mean, buy a new computer. Financial transactions on your computer, and it's an old computer, it's out of date, it's not the latest operating system, and it's not up to speed in all those ways, you need to protect yourself. And the right way to do that is to buy a computer and keep it up to date. Better still, buy a Mac. The Mac is less than 1/10 as susceptible because Apple is much more rigorous about the way it writes its software. So there are fewer vulnerabilities in it. But much more important than that, it's not a very attractive target because there are fewer of them. And they have a complex internal structure that if you're a teenager and you want to show your best friend what you just did, you'd have so much to explain to him or her about the internal structure of the Mac because this person only knows about the internal structure of the PC. So that it's just not attractive. It's not an attractive target. So you'd be better off with the Mac. Now, if you are sitting here thinking, oh, well, my computer is up to speed. It's a brand new Dell or whatever it is, and I do install the security updates, you're probably pretty safe. But let me ask you about your router. Your router is a computer also, and it sits between your computer and the outside network. And when was the last time it was updated? It has an operating system, a subset of Windows. And if it's more than 4 or 5 years old, it has vulnerabilities. And it could be seized by the teenagers. And then once they're there, this is like having your live-in nanny who has a lover who's a house burglar. Anything is go. So that's your personal worry about zombification. Okay, back to the Estonian incursion. What did the Estonian incursion actually accomplish? Well, nothing. 2 days later, everything's back to speed. No lasting, huge disruption, but no lasting impact. And this is the nature of a lot of cyber attacks. They don't damage anything. They disrupt, and they make everything hard to use for a while, and then they go away. They go away because the zombie rental is fairly substantial, and you only rent them for a certain period of time. So eventually they all end, and normal systems are back to operation within a few days. Well, that's one class of cyber warfare attack, and it would be, if it were directed to our economy, it would be probably more of a disruption, more of an annoyance than anything else. If it were directed toward the military's use of its own cyber assets, that could be different. Even though it was a purely cyber attack that didn't actually physically blow anything up or destroy anything, if it inhibited the military's ability to, for instance, steer a drone wherever it's steering a drone and causing it to send back images and location data and fire a missile, if it could do that, then it could be a substantial decrement to this country's ability to conduct its own foreign policy, its force majeure. Now, that is not completely out of the realm of the possibility, but it's much more difficult than anything I've shown you so far because the military doesn't use the internet. The military uses a series of parallel internets. One of which is the most highly secure is called the CIPRNet, and it is a secret internet protocol router network that uses an entirely different architecture. Its protocol of moving data in and around is different from the protocol of the internet, which means that someone that needs to penetrate it could penetrate it. I mean, you could have somebody that was a foreign national working for the Defense Department that got into the innards of it. You could conceivably penetrate it to some extent, but you wouldn't have the tens of thousands of active teenagers working on your behalf, producing tools that are available through toolkits to compromise other people's computers or selling zombies. You're on your own. You'd have to start from scratch. And it is much more secure. In the long run, this is an area where the United States Department of Defense has to be very aware of its vulnerabilities. And it is. It is very much aware. They're very serious. They understand the idea of a single point of failure and the limitations of it. So I would say this is a possible vulnerability, but not highly likely, at least not in the short term. Now, the second incursion I want to talk about is one that was practiced on Iran in 2009, and in particular, which took down the computers of the Iranian Nanants nuclear enrichment plant that are used to run the gas centrifuges let's see, do I have a pointer here? The gas centrifuges that are in here that are enriching uranium by spinning it around. All of these are run by a computer which is called a process control computer. And these were subject to a worm. A worm is a self-replicating malware program that was called Stuxnet that affected very specifically targeted process control systems at Nanats. A process control system is a computer which is connected to the control mechanisms of machines, of valves, of pumps, of switches that actually interacts mechanically with the real world, that actually controls stuff. The ones that it was targeted on were the ones that were running the centrifuges, the arrays of centrifuges. Stuxnet was the name of the worm, and nobody knows who made it, but as I begin to describe it to you, you'll see that it was not made by a couple of teenagers. It's a much bigger deal than that. It infected the Iranian semantic Siemens system for process control, the WinCC Step 7 process control systems that were driving the gas centrifuge cascades. I want to introduce this term social engineering because there was social engineering involved, and the social engineering is the manipulation of individuals to be part of an intrusion. In particular, at Nanants, we now can see from the code that propagated itself, the self-replicating worm, which went beyond Iran. It didn't do anything to most places because they didn't have gas centrifuges. It was looking for gas centrifuges. But it went beyond that to many other locations, many of them in the United States. And we could take the computer, which has been affected, apart and look at its memory and dope out what happened. And one of the things you can dope out is how it originally arrived on these computers. And it originally arrived with a social engineering plot involving the use of a memory stick. It came in on an infected memory stick that somebody somehow was enticed to stick into one of these computers to share some data or something like that. It immediately threw itself into the computer, grabbed control, and used that to bring the worm in and to begin its process of finding its way to the other computers on the network. If you learn it, so a memory stick is one of the ways that malware can get onto your computer. If you've learned anything here today, it is don't ever let anybody put his memory stick in your USB port without a condom. Very important. If you follow that rule, there's one kind of intrusion will not happen to you. Social engineering is a key part of all this, and it's a very upsetting part because we're so weak in that area. And my colleague Mark Seiden, who's a cybersecurity expert against cybercrime, not cyber warfare, he says that in the most secure organization that he visits, a middle-aged lady with a Polish accent and a hairnet pushing a trolley full of sandwiches can go anywhere. Can go absolutely anywhere. So we have this notion of security within organizations, but it's much softer than the security that we try to impose on our computer systems. A friend of mine, Rob Austin, who's a professor at Harvard Business School, went to a Cambridge area biogenetics company, highly secure, and they were demonstrating to him a super secure laboratory that you need three ways to access. Super security always involves three things: what you know, what you are, and what you have. So what you know is a password, and what you are is your thumbprint or your iris scan, and what you have is a key. And so they demonstrated to Rob how to enter the clean room laboratory by putting the key in, by having their iris scanned, and then by keying in a password, and then the door swings open. They're not actually going in because only the one person is authorized to go in. But as the door is swinging closed, they hear this somebody running up behind them, and he says, "Hold that door!" Okay. So much for triple security. So we're all subject to social engineering. It's not quite clear what happened at the Iranian facility. Possibly intruders went into the home of one of the workers and compromised his memory stick. And he inadvertently put it in without realizing what happened. But it happened multiple times because the first time they infected the computers, it didn't spread fast enough or didn't spread well enough. They weren't getting to the computers that they wanted to. So they revamped it, and they brought it in again on a memory stick, and infected more computers. It used a highly sophisticated zero days mechanism. That means it used some not yet detected and broadcast vulnerabilities, four of them. And the zero days idea is that it allowed itself to infect as many computers as it could reach before it actually implemented them. So at the time when something goes wrong, you have 0 days to react because your computers are already affected. It did that with a surprising effect. In fact, it went all over the world. But since the computer only looked for a particular environment, a facility that had 33 or more frequency-converted drives installed, all operating between 807 hertz and 1,210 hertz. If it doesn't find that, it just goes to sleep, or it continues to try to replicate itself and send it out, worm its way to other computers, but it doesn't do anything harmful. It went all over the world, but we know it was targeted on Iran because it had 1,000 times as much penetration in Iran as almost any place else. Now, what did the Iranian incursion accomplish? Well, more, because it could actually destroy things. It physically damaged centrifuges. The centrifuge is probably changed out because of physical damage. It's vibrating, so they break. It's changed out at the rate for that particular facility of about 100 a month. And while the Stuxnet was operating, they were changing out more than 1,000 a month. So they seriously set back the Iranian nuclear enrichment program. It might also leak information about the enrichment program. We don't know that for a fact because we're still taking it apart. Was there any lasting damage after it was removed? It's not, aside from the damage what happens when you speed the centrifuge up? It shakes itself loose. That's why they were breaking them, because they were raising the speed of running it. So process control systems can do some serious damage, lasting damage, but in this case it wasn't very much. Now, one of the things we know, because it's spread all over the place and there are many, many copies of it which have been, through a process of archaeology, have been examined, we know that this whole payload represents 1.5 megabytes. It's an enormous amount of code in there, very tightly written, beautifully written code. And 1.5 megabytes of code, you know, a couple of thousand lines of source code, plus all the research involved in going through it, this is a project of maybe 30 people for a year and a half or two years, which is what makes people think that this was a professional exploit built by a government. Most people think it was either the United States or Iran. Nobody's quite sure which, or I'm not quite sure which. The people that read the code are so good at what they're doing that they can tell the nationality of the people that write the code. They can tell the culture of the people that write the code. So I'm sure somebody knows whether some of the people who are analyzing it know whether it was the U.S. or Israel. But it almost certainly was one or the other, or both. The possibility is that it was both. These process control systems are used everywhere to run complex factories, chemical factories, and power supply systems. The power grid is run, or a power utility, a nuclear plant, for instance, is run with a process control system. And that brings up a very unsettling thought, that the power grid might be a really attractive target to somebody who is trying to damage us, do lasting damage. As it turns out, most power generating facilities have process control systems to run the plant, but are not controlled from outside by other higher-level process control systems. But that's changing, because there's this thing called the smart grid, which would enable global-level control of the power grid, not just an individual component, but the power grid, to move power from one place to another, to increase capacity in hydroelectric, Quebec Hydroelectric because you have about to have certain needs in Ohio or wherever. And that smart grid would open us to a kind of cross-grid exposure for cyber penetration, like Stuxnet. If we can do it to the Iranians, or the Israelis can do it to the Iranians, somebody might be able to get at the smart grid, which hasn't been built yet, but when it's built. One of my clients is the CIO of a large power trading company that also happens to be a power generating company. And since this is going out over the radio, I can't actually mention her name or the name of the company that she works for. I'm going to call her Miss X, and the company is the Y Corporation. But the Y Corporation, I can tell you, has power generating facilities in a dozen states and a very serious 100 megawatt class nuclear power plant. And Miss X is very much involved, very deeply involved in the National Information, the National Information and Standards Technology, NIST, effort to design the smart grid. And in this capacity, as one of the designers of the smart grid, she was invited to China to give a keynote address because China, too, has smart grid kinds of needs and is looking at the same thing. She was invited to China to give a keynote for a working group meeting about smart grid technologies, attended by people from all over the world. Before she left, the security people from the Y Corporation took her aside and said, "Miss X, you do not bring a laptop with you. You do not bring your BlackBerry with you. We're going to give you a throwaway cell phone, and that's all you're taking with you because we don't want you to be compromised in any way." So off she goes, and she gives her keynote, and they're making a lavish fuss over the people who are speaking at this working group meeting, particularly the foreigners, and they take them off to the Great Wall of China, and they take them off to fancy meals, and they visit Shanghai. I mean, it's a wonderful experience for her. She comes home with thousands of pictures, and she connects her camera, digital camera. She connects her digital camera to her laptop, and sees the first picture coming in, and my God, it takes a long time. She's wondering, why is that one picture, which she knows is 5 megapixels, is about 10 million bytes of data, why is it taking so long to get? And then all of a sudden, out of the corner of her eye, she sees her router start to light up with outgoing traffic from her laptop. Outgoing traffic from her laptop. She flies to the power switch and powers down the router and powers down the laptop and calls the security experts from the Y Corporation. They come in. They take the camera apart. They take the laptop apart to see what traces are left. And they look at what was received on the far end because what happened is her laptop dialed out to the Y Corporation's virtual private network. It took a chance that her password in logging on was the same password she used to log on to her email, and it had deduced what that password was. And it turns out they were right, and she actually logged on to her ID in the corporate system, and it had begun to download an exploit. Now, what happened here? Well, now you know enough to understand what happened. It was a classic buffer overflow exploit. Only it wasn't a teenager typing in all those lowercase p's. It was a camera. A camera is a computer. And they had, while she was away from her hotel room, gone and doctored her computer, put a different processor inside of it, and caused it to do a buffer overflow exploit on her laptop and to plant a payload which searched through all of her information, trying to deduce her passwords. It didn't actually succeed, but you can see it could have. And if it had, it would have planted a back door in the company's facility system. Okay, now I want to finish up by talking a little bit about cybercrime, because cybercrime is very much allied and in some ways more real to our economy, at least, than cyber warfare. One of the cyber crimes I want to talk about is a very low-tech one, and it has to do with if you went to your spam filter and did a search on it from your email client and searched on the word Nigeria, you would get a non-trivial number of hits. And if you looked at these messages, you would find that these people want to give you money, and they want to give you substantial amounts of money. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. This is what's called the Nigerian letter fraud, and it is one of the most widely used exploits, social engineering exploit. There's no technology involved here except email, and one of the most widely used exploits in cybercrime. How important is this? Well, 3 years ago, we had one of the Nieman Fellows, Ronki Adwale, a Nigerian journalist who was a Nieman Fellow, stayed with Sally and me, and she told us that the Nigerian letter fraud is the second largest source of foreign exchange for Nigeria after petroleum. So obviously a lot of people are doing this. James Fallows in the current issue of The Atlantic writes that a talented exploiter of this can make $500 in Nigeria, where he can't get a job, can make $500 a day, a talented Nigerian letter fraud exploiter. So I think our major exposure right now is not warfare in the traditional sense, but warfare in the economic sense. We are right now paying a price of $114 billion a year for cybercrime. That's what it costs us. That's what we're losing for cybercrime. And that is, I think a nice way to think about it, a transfer payment from rich nations to poor nations. It's a kind of involuntary foreign aid. And it's actually a relatively good one because it goes to low-level criminals who then spend the money within their countries and it benefits the economy, as opposed to a regular foreign aid which goes to high-level criminals that send it to Switzerland and it lands in vaults. So this is $114 billion. The BBC in November asserted that the true cost of cybercrime today is £800 billion per year. Well, you could fight a pretty decent little war for £800 billion a year. And so I think we are at war, but we're not exactly at war with China or at war with any other nation state. I conclude that the basic idea of a war, a cyber war, conducted largely or even exclusively in cyberspace, is a fantasy. But there is this ongoing cyber attack that is principally cyber crime. I can sense you staring off into the distance, wondering what the hell what it means. Well, what it means is in the short term, there will be a cyber component to virtually any war in the future. It probably will not be the major component. But meanwhile, we are at war to the tune of £800 billion a year with a legion of non-national forces that are attacking our economy through cybercrime, and that is the main thing that we need to be aware of. Thank you so much.